If you're more of a visual learner or you like seeing charts, breakdowns, and exploring other topics, check out our Student Loan Planner YouTube channel. We've got quick explainer videos, deep dives, smart money tips you can actually see in action. Just search Student Loan Planner on YouTube and hit subscribe. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner podcast brought to you by Travis for the past 10 years. So I feel like I've earned the right to just rant about whatever I want. Hopefully you'll be entertained by it. I think you will. Student loan borrowers are hit with a lot of marketing. A lot of these student loan borrowers are, you are probably a professional, high income, really educated, and you are probably online because you're listening to this podcast, right? So I think that you're probably a lot better informed than the average person. And one of the things you might have seen online in some amount of advertising, almost certainly if you have a Facebook or Instagram account, and maybe if you have a YouTube account, is some kind of message pitching financial planning services that says something to the order of, AUM fees are bad. This could destroy your wealth. Look at how much money you'll cost yourself over the long term if you use an AUM fee advisor. You know, hey, look, dumb people pay AUM fees, smart people pay flat fees, right? There's a lot of personal finance blogs out there that also echo this sentiment, right? That's like, you know, you're a high income doctor, like you're an idiot if you pay an AUM fee. Only fools do that. I think it's kind of interesting because I like to talk transparently about math, and I like to talk about when math is, in my opinion, being distorted and used for a specific purpose to achieve a certain axe to grind. This is just my opinion, so let me disclaim all that, right? I'm not saying anything about any other businesses being sketchy or anything. I just think that, well, maybe I am, I guess, because it's my opinion to not be straightforward with your marketing. But let's just use some examples here, okay? So there's a big company that starts with a F that has raised $200 million of capital. And one of their primary marketing messages is getting personal finance folks like Ramit Sethi, who's popular from the Netflix show. I guess I'll just say it. Screw it, right? So it's Facet, right? This big VC-funded company. And they hire people like a Ramit Sethi to go on Facebook and be like, hey, when fees are bad, only idiots pay them. Use Facet because it's a flat fee. They've raised $200 million and they have about $60 million in revenue a year. In contrast, like SLB Wealth has raised no money except for me and the other partners, and we're not beholden to VC investors. What's interesting to me is they're modeling out like AUM fee savings over like 30 plus years, but when you've raised $200 million from impatient VC PE type investors and you only have $60 million of revenue, I say only, but relative to a $200 million investment, I think that's fairly small, especially for a service-based business like financial planning, where the multiples are not SpaceX multiples of like, you know, 100x sales. Those people are going to get really impatient to get their money back. And eventually, they're probably going to force some kind of acquisition of that firm because they probably want to get paid back, would be my guess. And the savings you're supposedly going to lock in, well, are you really going to capture all those savings over many years? And first of all, too, I want to talk about what is often modeled. A lot of times when they do comparisons of AUM fees, and by the way, what's our conflict of interest, right? SLP Wealth has an AUM fee. It starts at 0.75% and it phases down as you have more assets down to a minimum of 0.25% at the time that I recorded this. Subject to change, of course, like anything in life, that's our AUM fee, right? And I'll explain why I actually think that helps us deliver better value for clients that value their time. So I'll talk about that in a little bit. But again, I talked about Facet, I talked about personalities that promote them, right? When you raise $200 million of capital, there's a lot of money going around that you can get as endorsements to promote whatever angle that they think they need from a marketing perspective to try to grow really fast. Fees absolutely matter. Let me say that for a second. I'm not saying AUM fees don't matter at all. Like, that's a joke. Like, of course fees matter at some level, of course. The issue is fees have to represent value. Anytime, anywhere, in any service, I don't care what it is, what you are paying has to be a good deal for the service level you're receiving. What I kind of experience is if the service is terrible, the only reason that you deal with it is if you have to. RIP Spirit Airlines, but you take that one option because, you know, that's the only choice you have, right? Or, you know, maybe it's the only nonstop flight to the destination and you're willing to put up with the awfulness. So it's like, if you don't have to have something, you want the service to be really excellent to be worth paying anything for it. So a couple thoughts on some comparisons real quick. So a lot of people point out how Vanguard saved fees from active management, right? It used to be a primarily active managed world with very high mutual fund fees of, you know, 1-2%. And Vanguard came in, brought in index fund investing, pushed down costs. Investors got to keep more of their returns. Investors are much wealthier as a result. So why is it not one-to-one comparison to say, well, you know, Vanguard is slashing all these fees and therefore financial planners that charge AUM fees, those are bad because those mutual fund fees were bad that people were charging. So those fees are bad too. The issue that I would take with that, so the 1-1.5% fees that the mutual funds were charging were basically an aggregate to deliver market returns. If you bought 5 or 10 active mutual funds in a portfolio of high fee funds, you're kind of mirroring the market anyway, and you end up with market-like returns minus 1-1.5%. So how is that not equivalent to financial planning? How is that not the same exact story? It's because if you actually have a good advisor, they are looking out for a bunch of things you're probably doing wrong that you don't even realize you're doing wrong. Specifically, behavioral finance is undefeated in terms of mistakes people make. What we see people do all the time is after a huge run-up in growth stocks or tech stocks or Bitcoin or whatever it is, whatever hot thing was going well recently, people are piling into it. That is human behavior. It is undefeated. It happens every time there's a boom and bust cycle. It especially happens among really smart people that feel like, oh, I'm not smart unless I get in on the action. And then when the markets crash, people get overly conservative, they get scared to invest, they don't contribute regularly, they abandon their investment plans. That has a huge negative impact, huge negative impact. Vanguard actually put out a study called Vanguard Advisors Alpha, and it was targeted at financial planners to try to help Vanguard with their investment advisory business. But I actually think it makes a lot of sense. So they say that this would be worth about 1.5% per year in performance just by helping people avoid performance chasing. And if you think you've never done performance chasing, then you're probably not being honest with yourself because everybody does it a little bit. Oh my gosh, this asset class way outperformed this past year. Maybe I need a little bit more of it. Oh my gosh, look how Real Estate Investment Trust did. I better get some more of that. Oh my gosh, look how Airbnbs have performed after the pandemic. I should go buy an Airbnb too. That's the example of like performance chasing behavior that, you know, a lot of times a human advisor can help temper that. Let's say, oh, I don't think I'm guilty of that. I would never be guilty of that. I'm too smart for that. Well, okay. Tax-efficient asset location. I cannot tell you how often I see folks having the wrong type of accounts in the wrong places, or they have the same allocation of U.S. and international across all their accounts when you might want to allocate more towards the less tax-efficient stuff like international, more so in retirement accounts, and the U.S. stuff more so in the less tax-efficient accounts like the brokerage accounts. A lot of times we see people holding taxable bonds in their taxable accounts, which is not good at all because you're paying unnecessary taxes on the interest income. And, you know, also we see people holding on to tons of cash that they don't need to just because they're paralyzed, just because they're busy. That doesn't make any sense either. Now, a couple other things that can add some value, tax loss harvesting and brokerage accounts. People say, oh, that's stupid. I'm only going to save. I get this is kind of an interesting point. They'll say, I only save $3,000 a year with tax loss harvesting, and that's only on my 40% tax rate. So I'm only saving $1,200 a year. Tax loss harvesting sounds like a bunch of hoopla. It sounds like it's super oversold. I actually think in some cases it can be a little oversold, but that represents a complete lack of understanding of tax loss harvesting, because what you do is you build up paper losses by trading stuff that's similar but not identical. So for example, you go from the total stock market index fund to the S&P 500 index fund, wait your 30 days, and then swap back. And over time, you build up a bunch of different losses. And the key part of this is in a bunch of different positions. So if you're regularly investing, you are building up big losses on some positions and not as big losses on other positions. And what that does is it creates stocks with basically low cost basis. Now, what does that mean in English? It means that if you were to sell the wrong shares, you could generate a huge amount of taxable gains. But if you sell the right shares, you could generate a lot less capital gains. The only scenario where tax loss harvesting doesn't work very well is if you never sell anything. So yes, if you are planning to die with all of your assets and you are planning to get the step up in basis and give all of your money to your heirs, then yeah, there's not a whole lot of point to tax loss harvesting. But hey, guess what? What's the point of investing in that situation? Are you just trying to help your third generation develop a drug habit? I'm not trying to be too facetious, but like, you know, you don't want to invest for your third or fourth or fifth generation, because if you look at any rich person in history, it all falls apart. Eventually, we all go to dust. There's no such thing as a dynastic legacy. The legacy ends at some point. And guess what? Even like Ramses the 22nd or whatever in Egypt, right? You look at thousands of years of like the same family controlling ancient dynasties, eventually they all fall. Eventually it all ends. There is nothing permanent under the sun, from my faith perspective, except for heaven, right? A lot of people want to stack and stack and stack, but that, I would argue, is not the purpose of wealth. It is to help you live out your calling, whatever you define that as. So let's think about more value add there. The tax-loss harvesting, supposedly, according to an MIT study, can add something like 0.8 to 1% a year in performance. Another item is from this Vanguard Advisors Alpha study is managing cost basis. I had a case the other day where one of my consultants told me that somebody had come to them for a student loan planner consult and they had paid six figures on their student loans from their brokerage accounts and they hadn't changed the cost basis on Vanguard. That was disastrous for them. They had a very large brokerage account. They did first in, first out, which is the default method. So if you have ETFs at Vanguard, those are stocks technically. So the default is first in, first out, meaning that if you go hit the sell button, it's going to go sell the earliest shares you've ever bought. If you say, I want to sell 500 shares to get however much money, it's going to go look at the oldest shares. And that's probably the shares you have the biggest gains on. Instead, you could have done specific identification of shares and manually selected the shares that have the lowest gains. What this person did is they generated, I think, at least five figures of unnecessary gains, but it might have even been more than that. And they paid tens of thousands minimum of extra unnecessary taxes they could have avoided. That is really painful. That is really painful. And so cost basis management, that's something that is estimated by Vanguard's Advisors Alpha paper to add something like maybe 1.1% over time. If you sum up all of the different ways that people tend to mess up their investments, it can easily add up to way more than 1%, and it does, and people that don't realize that generally have overconfidence bias. I think that we have to call a spade, and realize that just because you are very, very smart doesn't mean that you know everything about every field under the sun. A lot of people think, and I think this is just reality, I think a lot of people think, I'm brilliant, I went to medical school, I went to dental school, I went to law school, except vet school, etc., and I'm smarter than most financial advisors, so why would I like listen to them and not just do it myself, because the 1% is a ripoff and that's ridiculous. I think a lot of people kind of think that to themselves, but I would posit this. Do I think that my SAT score was higher than my plumber? Probably. It probably was. Actually, I'm not sure. My plumber's pretty smart, but you know, but it probably was. Do I think simultaneously that when it comes to his domain knowledge, where he specializes in plumbing all day, that he knows a lot more than I do about it? Abso-freaking-lutely. Would I trust what he tells me on plumbing because of his high ratings and his high client satisfaction scores and how in-depth he explains things to me? Definitely. Folks that are dismissive of professionals that are not as academically gifted as them, it can be to your detriment. Just to be clear, if you think about other areas of your life, there's a lot of times where you should be trusting the person who maybe is not as academically smart as you, but is more specialized than you. So hopefully that kind of makes sense. And honestly, some folks probably secretly have way higher SAT scores than you would expect. I mean, you know, there's a lot of smart people in every field, regardless of what the role is. Like, I think my dad told me one of the smartest people I ever met one time was like a Mensa member that worked in the wheelbarrow department at the Home Depot in the 80s or something. And he just was like super smart, but he just enjoyed that work and he had like a crazy high IQ and whatever. I mean, I think that every human deserves respect, but you do need to protect yourself. What do I mean by protect yourself? You should absolutely ask the question, are AOM fees a ripoff? I'm not suggesting that you should not ask the question. I think you should continue looking and challenging the math and deciding, why are people saying that? Let's talk about a couple other things. Let's talk about other business models that charge percentage-based models. General contractors. I use a general contractor for my home renovation. I paid a percentage of the home renovation. Why is that model in place? It's to avoid having to constantly talk about the conversation of scope creep. If they are working on a particular part of the home, they get paid for it, right? If I ask them to, hey, can you also handle redoing this other part of the project that was originally not agreed upon prior to that? The answer can always be yes with that percentage-based model, but it's something they get paid on versus like if I'm paying an hourly fee to a general contractor or something, I've got to track everything. They have an incentive to take more time because that's how they get paid more. So everything has conflicts of interest, right? But in general, the percentage-based model, that's a reasonable model for paying a general contractor. Now, let me explain why in isolation, that can go really south. So that's basically what happened with me in my home renovation. I had a terrible experience with my general contractor and my, you know, just in designer. Terrible, terrible, terrible experience. Why? One thing is I didn't feel like my interior designer, at least, even actually told me the truth about what we were paying. I think that she dramatically understated the percentages that we were actually being marked up at. And that was frustrating. So obviously you should know what your fees are. You should feel comfortable talking to any professional about what am I paying and why and how. And they should be able to explain why it's valuable. And then also I will say this, if the 25% or whatever I paid to have our home renovation done, if it had been done excellently and I hadn't had to redo a whole bunch of stuff that this person did, and I had a low stress experience dealing with them, if they had made my wife happy instead of just me banging my head against the wall constantly trying to fix things that were going wrong. And if, again, this is my opinion, if they had designed the drain properly for the home, my basement might not have been destroyed in a tropical storm because of the flood that occurred, that in my opinion, they should have known how to protect against if they had hired somebody. It's my fault. I didn't hire somebody that had a lot of experience. I didn't realize they didn't have a lot of experience, but I got a raw deal. I did not get a raw deal because of the percentage-based model that I was charged on my home. I got a raw deal because the service and the value of the help that the person provided wasn't there. I think that is where the AUM fees are bad vibes come from, because if you're charged 1.5% a year from a wirehouse bank advisor who lives in your town, goes to the Rotary Club, they charge 1.5% on $2 million and they do absolutely nothing for you. All they do is send you 40 articles from their wirehouse, or they like pick a model allocation for you and you can come and talk to them at their office, and maybe they play golf a little bit for you. Like, is a $30,000 a year fee worth doing very little for you? No, it's not. It's a ripoff, right? In contrast, if that 1.5% fee on $2 million, if that involved, and by the way, that's not our fee, but if it involved deep tax loss harvesting, preventing you from making cost basis mistakes, tax efficiency, if it helped you with business planning, if it helped you with estate planning, if it helped you with, you know, insurance planning, right? If they, and in other words, a lot of times what the AUM fee does is they have the fee and then they want to feel like they're justifying it. So there's different directions it can go. The more ethical, like fiduciary kind of RIA type of model, like the stuff that you hear talked about on like the Kitsis podcast, which is one of the main like industry podcasts for financial advisors out there. They talk about, yes, the AUM fees could be high, but what advisors are doing to keep clients is they add a ton of services. They just keep adding services to maintain the justification for charging the fee. But the services they add are very real and very valuable. And so that's kind of going back to my earlier point, is it's all about, is there lots of value added for whatever you're paying? You know, when you look at a lot of these firms, they're spending probably seven figures a month on Facebook ads in some cases that are sort of just their marketing shtick is AUM fees are bad, AUM fees are bad. They also laid off half of their financial advisors in some cases, and they are probably trying to position towards an exit, maybe. And who knows what's going to happen to all their clients. I think that the real question on any service is like, are you valuable or not? Like an SLP consult somewhere else, let's say you could get one for $200. Actually, I know you could get one for $200 somewhere else. If that consult is not that valuable in general, like the service isn't great, that's $200 that's wasted. If an SLP consult with SLP has got thousands of reviews, which it does, which you can Google and check me on online, and generally has really high satisfaction scores, that might be more than worth the $600. Hopefully this makes sense, right? Like a 1.5% or 1% AUM fee at one place could be a ripoff, and a 1% AUM fee somewhere else could be really highly valuable. And again, that's with us not even charging that amount. But I want to talk about a little other thing. So a lot of times when they do the comparisons of like the flat fee versus the 1% fee with the 30-year kind of time horizon, that's not how AUM fees work at most places. Most places do recognize economies of scale, as we do, and you tend to lower the fee as somebody's got more assets. For example, a lot of firms will charge pretty low percentages on really large numbers. So for example, at the time I'm recording this, our number for assets over $5 million is 0.25%. So the idea that you're going to pay 1% forever and always when they're modeling like the savings of AUM versus flat fee, that's generally the kind of design to try to make their flat fee look good. And often what it also does is it doesn't account for the fact that like a lot of these places expand the flat fee a lot, right? And to be clear, like you have to charge a flat fee, in my opinion, if you're working with people who are don't have millions of dollars yet in a lot of cases. And the reason is because if you have somebody that's got $10,000, you know, and let's say you were charging even a 2% fee on that, well, that's $200 a year on $10,000. That's not enough money to service a client well. Does that make sense? So I think that that's something to be honest about there. So, you know, there's a couple other things I think are interesting. There's a lot of activity happening in the doctor space and financial planning. One firm recently started that's partnered with a alternative investments like kind of company. And what's ironic is this company is talking about AOM fees are bad, AOM fees are bad. It's all over their website. But if you look at the way they charge for investments, it kind of backs up to being an AOM fee. It is roughly a percentage because they charge flat fees per certain dollar amount. So it works out to an AOM fee. It's just not exactly an AUM fee. So it's like, what? This is a marketing shtick, right? The same firm partnering with the alternative investments firm, from my knowledge, just kind of researching on AI tools, like it seems like that firm charges a 2% AUM fee with a 20% profit fee. So the infamous 2 and 20 for hedge funds. And they get a bunch of doctors to sign up for their real estate syndication or fund kind of stuff. I'm not super familiar with it, but just again, from my AI research with that disclaimer, it seems like even though the promotional materials claim that there's no way that they're going to have any kind of big conflict with, you know, steering anybody into the funds. Oh, well, a lot of our readers invest with them anyway. Well, it's like, dude, like you say AOM fees are bad and then you're like 2 and 20 on, you know, this advertising partner. I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm no saint, but there's a reason when like these real estate folks like wanted to advertise on our site way back in the day, I told them heck no, because like the first time there's a really bad recession in 2008, people aren't going to be able to get their money back. People are going to have illiquidity problems. They're going to have one at redemptions. They're not going to be able to get it from some funds. And the one great thing about public markets is there's always a price. If you have to transact, there's always a price, even if the price sucks. That's what's interesting about a lot of these private investments is what they don't talk to you about. And again, how do you mislead people with math and statistics? Try not marking to market. Investments look fantastic when you don't mark them to market value. Warren Buffett's got a famous quote, if your neighbor was leaning over across the fence every day and yelling at you what your house was worth and the value of your house was going way down or way up, you might get freaked out about the value of your home price. Why do people tend to not get super freaked out by it? Because you don't actually see it viscerally on a statement like you do for public markets. And so what happens is with wealthy investors hate the idea of seeing their portfolios go down. And they hate the idea of feeling like they're simple or their portfolios are simple. And so firms want to justify high fees and they want to get high fees and get finder's fees. And so what do? They go out and they add a bunch, you know, a sleeve of the portfolio to alternative investments that gives huge fees or at least adds the veneer of complexity or makes you feel excitement in life and talk, you know, you hush, hush whisper of like, well, I'm a accredited investor, so I'm special, right? Like I'm better than everybody else. I don't know. Like the reality is I think that these high fee funds, man, I mean, like there's a reason that like people are involved in this. They like money, in my opinion. I think that's what you see a lot of with alternative investments is it's not enough to just do boring and just nail the blocking and tackling, right? You got to do something exotic. Otherwise, people are scared that you might quit. I just think that there's so much value to add in the basics of like doing excellent portfolio construction and people just absolutely don't do it. And they a lot of times have no awareness that they're not doing it. That's what blows my mind, right? Is I will like, there's this new tool that we're able to kind of like see how much people are underperforming by and mistakes they're making with their portfolios. And we're able to pump this in. And it's like, not uncommon to see like, oh, this person underperformed by like 3% or 4%. And meanwhile, a lot of those same people are like, AOM fees are bad. I hate 1% AOM fees. And it's like, well, dude, did you realize you underperformed by 4%? And you realize that your portfolio construction makes no sense? I mean, I'm not trying to be a jerk, but like, again, I think that people are thinking about cost and not value. And I will say this, I'm going to say something a little controversial here. Think about anybody who has a business. If you have a business or know somebody who has a business, think about some medical professionals have no choice. If you're a emergency room physician, you have to take everybody. You don't get the luxury of picking who you serve. You know, maybe a dentist does get that luxury in some ways. Now think about the patients that come in that are super cost conscious and focused on cost. Now think about the patients that are super concerned about value, the total mouth restoration that, you know, the person's just super worried about the cost, really stressed, really worried. And then you have the person who comes in and just, I want it to look excellent. I want the experience to be excellent. I'm not as concerned about what the cost is as long as the service and what I get is tremendous. And think about which one is easier to serve and more pleasant to serve. You have only so many hours on earth, and you know what? So do financial advisors. I'm going to be really honest here, okay? Why would any advisor who's really good be interested in having to like do hourly fees and quantify all their hours and quantify, like figure out what the scope includes and excludes for flat fees, right? And constantly having to adjust those every so often. I think the only reason you start with flat fee is frankly to be able to serve more people because a lot of people don't have investments. But what I'm sort of thinking about in this line of thinking here is like, I think it's kind of cocky and arrogant to be like, advisors have got to serve people with flat fees and only good advisors are ones that charge flat fees. Okay, why don't you go do it? Why don't you have to go deal with an SEC audit or the massively annoying compliance rules that exist or the insane regulations that you have to deal with to be able to compliantly serve people? You know, instead of trying to dodge regulations and dodge rules, right? Like somebody sent me this YouTube video recently and it was like, AI is a bubble. They're only floating a small percentage of the market cap to prop up the price, transfer the losses to retail investors' wealth through index funds, which they're forced to buy. They're manipulating the indexes, blah, 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 blah. That could be the case. But the difference is these folks on YouTube were able to mouth off and say whatever the heck they want. And they were able to offer guarantees, which they have no accountability for. As an SEC registered investment advisor with SLP Wealth, we can't do those guarantees because that's illegal. Does that make sense? So it's just so interesting to me how a lot of people will be like, oh, advisors are scumbags. They're greedy. They're trying to get rich. Like, you know who gets rich? 2 in 20 hedge funds that convince a bunch of unsophisticated physicians and dentists to turn over a big chunk of their life savings to super high fee real estate syndications. And then having physician like content creators and personal finance blogs get paid huge kickbacks to push these investments on people and then not register as securities solicitors and like make a bunch of money from doing that. It's legal, but in my opinion, I wouldn't do it. I just think it's just hilarious. Meanwhile, like think about SLP. Why did I start SLP? Because I felt like it was way easier to outperform with really good student loan advice than it was trying to get an extra 10 basis points with active management and a bond fund. That's what I used to do. I used to be a bond trader. I was trying to eke out an extra 10 basis points of return. And it was really, really hard. Really, really hard. Like you go to bat against some of the smartest people out there for the smallest amount of alpha. And like, it's really tough. It's really tough to outperform in the bond markets. And it's tough to outperform for very much. Meanwhile, you got over here, people making all these PSLF mistakes and throwing away six figures like candy, because they just didn't realize they were making mistakes. So it's like, oh, okay, the value add is over here. Now with SLP Wealth, I want to be transparent that part of the reason we started it was because I wanted something fun to do in case Biden forgave all student loans. That was a possibility. The student loan interest pause was going on forever and always. And so I thought, well, shoot, I should at least do something else interesting in case this all goes to nothing. So I'm glad we did that. And what I realize, what I become more and more convinced of is everybody overestimates their skills relative to busyness and inertia that exists. So for example, if you look at people's Roth IRAs, a lot of times they're way smaller than they should be. Why? Because people got busy. People forgot to do them. People forgot to make the contribution for the tax year. And then by the time they remembered, it was too late. So add up a couple to a few years of missed backdoor Roth IRAs, and now you're paying maybe, can't say guarantees at all for anything, right? But maybe you're paying for decades worth of management fees on that account in that case. Same thing for brokerage accounts. You make one bad mistake where you sell the wrong share lots to fund a big purchase, you could have just paid for years worth of management fees. The other thing that we don't talk about enough too is our advisors reaching out to try to encourage you to contribute more instead of just let the money pile up in cash. That has a big value add. So it's not just the cost on the assets itself. It's what services happen in terms of like growing your wealth overall. It's not just wealth maximization, though. I think a lot of advice sometimes is geared around making you the richest person in the cemetery. I think that's wrong. I think that it's harder for a camel to get through the eye of the needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Like that's a verse in the Bible. I'm not theologically aware enough to know exactly what it means, but I know it means that wealth doesn't bring happiness. There's a lot of things out there that say that in different religions, and I think that that's true, that wealth can help remove barriers to happiness. It can take stress away from your life. It can take away strain on your marriage. It can take away burdens of paying for healthcare for, you know, loved ones. I'm not minimizing the importance of having some significant amount of wealth. I do think that that can be a good tool that is helpful. But over and above a certain level, like, your life doesn't change. It's all funny money. I think that trying to be, again, the richest person in the cemetery is not helpful. I think a lot of times people get wealthy and they, like, have never been asked tough questions. It's like, what do you want your legacy to be? Do you want your kids spending all this money? Are you scared about what happens when your children inherit $5 million? Are you interested in retiring earlier while you're still healthy in your 50s? Because you told me, hey, your parents only made it to their 60s. And, like, do you want, just in case you have similar health to your parents, do you want to do something different, right? Do you want to build the house on the lake and take a chance on that? Do you want to travel Europe or backpack across the Swiss Alps or whatever it is, whatever your dreams are? I'm a lot more of a big believer in big dreams, kind of like how I love big telescopes now, and I'm kind of crazy and I just buy all these big telescopes because I love looking at the stars and creation and I get so excited when I look up at the night sky. Yeah, I'm weird. And I bet you're a little bit unique too. And whatever unique goals or dreams that you have, I believe that you should live them instead of not live them or have them put off. And ultimately, are AUM fees bad? Maybe. I don't know. Maybe that's the conclusion of this. If you hear somebody religiously claiming, almost like with an article of faith, that AUM fees are bad, that's a binary, like, clickbaity kind of thing. They can be bad. It's bad if it's bad service and too high of a price. But it could be some of the most valuable fees that you pay in the same token if you get a lot of value out of it and you get a richer life optimized for what matters to you. And if you save your time that you can use towards other things that you care about more than double checking you did all the Form 8606, Roth IRA, backdoor tax loss harvesting trades, etc. correctly. Anyways, I would just humbly suggest, do you know the difference between FIFO, LIFO, average cost, and spec ID? Do you rebalance regularly in a way that doesn't create unnecessary taxes? Do you make regular contributions to all the right accounts and maximize all the tax-deferred ones? Do you donate through charitable contributions to donor-advised funds instead of directly? Do you know how much would change with different itemized deductions that you could take this tax year and what the impact of the increased SALT limits are going to be? Do you know how all of this integrates with the fact that you might be a six-figure student loan borrower that has a high income, but you're not rich yet? That's what we specialize in. I have to say, SLP Wealth is an SEC registered investment advisor, and this is not investment advice. And I can't make any guarantees, but what I can say is that if you try this out for a month, you would either find out that this looks pretty cool, this seems pretty cool, or if you let us know within a month of trying the service, we'll give you that first month's money back. So that's a pretty good deal. And if you use our podcast special, is just slpwealth.com, just go to the site and click the Get Started button. And that link should apply $100 off discount off your first month. So you frankly do have to try it out for, like, at least a few months to really feel the value, because we do a lot of different things over those several months. And if this is not for you at all, that's totally cool. You can do the Student Loan Planner consult service at studentloanplanner.com/book. That's the one-time service for just student loans, right? That's the appropriate service for somebody that doesn't want a full level of financial planning for a six-figure student loan borrower that's a high-income earner, right? Not everybody fits that bill. You might have lower income. You might have not a desire, even after listening to me rant about something that's weird, like AUM fees. Like, you might be like, I'm still good. Okay, great. Life is short. That's what I love about direct conversations and honesty, right? Is life is so short. Like, if you listen to me and think, I'm not convinced at all, awesome. But I would much rather tell you truthfully what I think than just beat around the bush and say nothing, because I think that's so boring. So anyways, the big idea today was get value out of whatever service you hire and demand that there's value and use companies that, like, will speak to you plainly about what they think and not try to, like, whatever, just, like, puff you up and say stuff that's, like, not honest. I think that I would welcome a debate about any one of these topics with any of our clients ever. Like, I love talking about this stuff because I'm not afraid of having the conversation. If I wanted to be fabulously wealthier, I would probably start an alternative investments fund and convince people that the solution to their sadness in their workplace and the boringness that they feel in the regular humdrum of everyday life is open an account with me, with my private real estate fund, and I will deliver the dreams of passive income that you've always wanted most. And meanwhile, my fees are so high, it makes even the more expensive AUM fee advisors out there look cheap. But that's not me. I am who I am. I'm comfortable in my skin, and I'm grateful that you listen to this podcast and tolerate me for some minutes of your day, be it every week or every month, or maybe if this is even your first time, welcome. So thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. Again, if you want to try us out over at the financial planning side and you want to see what the really high impact value of combined financial planning investments all under one roof for six-figure borrowers that have high incomes, that's you, check out slpwealth.com and click on that Get Started button if you want that ongoing relationship and ongoing accountability towards getting to where you want to be. And if you want that one-time service that will get you just the student loan plan, that's okay too. studentloanplanner.com/book. Thank you all for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week.